Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. U.S. President Donald Trump and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe are mixing business with pleasure on the second day of their multi-day summit by golfing at Trump's course near his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida. Moments before the presidential motorcade arrived, it was met by a couple of dozen of protesters carrying signs, some of which said, "Stop hate." The two leaders began 2 days of talks Friday morning at the White House, where Trump spoke about the importance of the relationship between the U.S. and Japan.
The bond between our two nations and the friendship between our two peoples runs very, very deep. This administration is committed to bringing those ties even closer.
Mr. Abe said he and President Trump had reached an agreement on a new framework for economic talks, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be among the topics being discussed. Mr. Trump said any trading relationship between the two countries must be, in his words, free, fair, and reciprocal. United States immigration authorities arrested hundreds of immigrants living in the United States illegally in raids across the country this week. Although authorities say the enforcement action wasn't linked to a recent order signed by President Trump, a Department of Homeland Security spokesperson told the Washington Post the raids targeted criminals that were illegally in the country and they were part of a routine action. Afghan officials say a suicide car bombing attack targeting a military vehicle killed at least 7 people and wounded many others in the southern province of Helmand on Saturday. The Taliban is claiming responsibility for the attack. From here in Washington, this is VOA News. The United States has blocked the appointment of a former Palestinian official to lead the United Nations political mission in Libya. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres plans to name the Western-educated economist Salam Fayyad to the position. Fayyad served as Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority from 2007 to 2013 and was the authority's finance minister. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Nikki Haley, says the United States is, in her words, disappointed by the choice of Fayyad. Voters in northern India's Uttar Pradesh are deciding Saturday who will deliver a crucial midterm verdict on Prime Minister Narendra Modi and whether he can overtake the influence of the ruling party. Ajoy Bose is an independent political analyst in New Delhi.
The fact is that the rest of his term, Mr. Modi, will be looking over his shoulder if he does badly in these elections. On the other hand, if he does well, then I think he will get breathing space and he would have time to recover.
Polls are being held in 5 states, but none is more crucial to the political fortunes of Modi as Uttar Pradesh. Voting, that is, will continue for the next 4 weeks. Backed by Turkish troops, Syrian rebels have pushed into the Islamic State-held town of Al-Bab, just north of Aleppo. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the opposition forces took control of a hospital as they made their way into the city during the week-long fighting. Turkish-run state media reports that one Turkish soldier was killed and another wounded during the fighting Saturday. More than 60 Turkish soldiers have been killed during the operation, including 3 who were killed Thursday when Russian airstrikes accidentally targeted their position. Indonesian clerics are rallying voters in the capital Saturday to vote for Muslim politicians in the city and district elections across the country next week. The clerics in Jakarta want Muslims to vote out the city's Chinese Christian governor, who is on trial for blasphemy. Saturday is the last day politicians can campaign before Wednesday's vote. Indonesia is the world's most populous majority Muslim nation and has a large Christian minority. And rescuers in southern Philippines are searching buildings for possible survivors after a powerful earthquake struck, killing at least 6 people and injuring dozens more. There have been nearly 100 aftershocks. From here in Washington, I'm Michael Brown reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
The resignation just came today, and the general defected 7 days ago. In a military language, the best thing to say is that the person has defected. After then, he wrote a resignation from outside.
A top South Sudanese army official resigns.
The Minister of Communication, in his message to his staff for the New Year wishes ceremony, warning media not to report issues about the cessation or the calls for independence by the Anglophone rights movement.
The Cameroonian National Communication Council warns against the reporting on calls for strikes in the English-speaking areas of the country.
Section 43, subsection 3 of the Public Elections Act of 2012 in Sierra Leone, it is very clear that the Electoral Commission will have to announce a date for presidential elections.
And a Sierra Leonean opposition leader issues an ultimatum to the Electoral Commission to announce the date for next year's elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Lieutenant General Thomas Cerulo Swaka, a respected South Sudanese army official, has resigned. Swaka, the deputy head of logistics, accuses soldiers in the army of rape and killing civilians. He also said the military, police and other security branches systematically recruited Dinka from the president and chief of army staff's home region. Swaka said soldiers from the Dinka ethnic group have been strategically deployed and posted in non-Dinka areas to support the policy of land occupation. For reaction, I reached Atteni Wekateni, presidential spokesman in the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
The resignation just came today, and the general defected 7 days ago. In a military language, the best thing to say is that the person has defected. After then, he wrote a resignation from outside. So if we were really actually trying to change things, if he was different from the general that he's actually, you know, alleging that he's leaving the country for them, he would have done this when he was still inside South Sudan.
The general expressed concern about the fact that the soldiers in the National Army are abusing civilians, and there appears to be increasing ethnic favoritism in the military. In this case, the president's ethnic group, the Dinka, appears to be enjoying some favoritism. You don't think those concerns are legitimate that a government needs to look into to address?
No, it's just sugarcoating to justify his defection. General Cerulo has been the SPLA commander since 1991, and so he has been with the same army for more than 28 years. I don't know why the army, which is the same army until 7 days ago when he was still there, Deputy Chief of Staff for Logistics, was still in National Army until today on his resignation as a Dinka militia. Didn't he not know that it was a Dinka militia 11 years ago? The army is directed always by commanders, and he's part of those who are directing the SPLA. If he really knows that the SPLA has committed atrocities or committed violations since 2013, and he had waited until yesterday or today, then he is also guilty because he's the one directing the army.
You know, he is respected internationally because of the work he's done with the South Sudanese army. Now he's expressing concern, or he's saying that the military raped and killed civilians and allowed tribal militias to commit the same abuses, as well as running a network of secret prisons where torture was endemic. He's saying, as a person from the inside, and don't you think that as a government, you should look effectively into this, effectively investigate this, to find out where the problem is, to address them, rather than, you know, throw shade at him?
It's the same army that made him to be respected. He was not respected because he was having his own army or he was alone.
in the SPLA. So if he come out today because he has grievances, that some of which are not even justified, and just try to throw away the reputation of the Sudan People Liberation Army that has liberated this country overnight because he is complaining about certain individuals that he thinks that they were prostrating him, then how can he continue to be respected when in actual fact he destroyed the material in which he was actually respected for?
Some people are saying that his resignation, or what you call his defection, and his subsequent statement is a strong indictment on your government. Why wouldn't the government even establish a body to investigate what he has said?
In fact, the government will not just sit, doing practically nothing. The Security Council of South Sudan has set today to decide on what to do in regards to those, allegations. But the crucial point is Thomas Rilo Uswaka has another motive, which he did not say, as a motive because he wanted the people of South Sudan, and particularly those members of the army who are not Bari, from his own tribe, Bari, to stay in Juba while owning no land completely. So he is actually, because he wanted to fight for the land in Juba. So this is another, motive that he has been driving. And he has been mentioning this.
Attorney Wek Attorney is the South Sudanese presidential spokesman. He spoke with me from Juba. The Cameroonian National Communication Council, or NCC, has warned against the reporting on calls for strikes. Offenders, it says, will face sanctions. This after the regulatory body warned 8 media groups that they risk suspension or permanent prohibition for disseminating what it called seditious and disturbing content. The NCC says activists who have been agitating against alleged marginalization by the administration in Yaoundé are presenting undemocratic demands. For the latest development in English-speaking Cameroon, I reach Franklin Sone Bayen, an independent multimedia journalist.
It's rather ridiculous to hear the media regulator. Also even the Minister of Communication in his message to his staff for the New Year Wishes ceremony, warning media not to report issues about cessation or the calls for independence by the Anglophone rights movements, and even their calls for a federation, which is what obtained when the English-speaking part of the country rejoined the French-speaking part of the country at independence. There was a federation which was scrapped in 1972. So to say that it's a taboo subject is ridiculous, especially when it comes with the arm of the law, as if discussing that is an illegal thing.
Talking about the media, a lot of people are trying to find out where these two journalists, supposedly arrested by state security agencies, are. What have you heard on this matter so far?
We got to learn that they were held at a local charge office not far from where they were picked up, within the vicinity of the university in Boya called Moliko.
Are there any charges against them?
They apparently held in relation to being in possession of tracks that are promoting the strikes, the boycotts, and the ghost towns. The boycott of the national festival that took place today, 11th February, which marked the plebiscite of English-speaking Cameroon voting to join, obtain independence as part of the rest of Cameroon. So they're supposed to be held in relation with being in possession of the tracks, the two of them. And then the third person, whom we understand or we're told, printed or transported the tracks from Bamenda, we hear is already being held in Yaoundé. So the fear is that they too may be taken over to Yaoundé.
Let's talk about the observation of the Youth Day today.
The calls by the Anglophone rights movement for a boycott of the event today has been observed, with mixed feelings, has gone 50-50 somehow. The two main towns of the northwest, Bamenda, and the southwest, Boya, ceremonies took place, bigger ceremony in Boya than in Bamenda, but the mere fact that it happened in Bamenda is kind of a 50-50 for those who call the strike and for the government. The government think that it's a success that the event took place at all, even though very few schools turned out, very few students turned out to march, just about three or four secondary schools took part in the march past, and most of them are bilingual schools. And when you hear bilingual schools, you know that most of them are Francophone students. The University of Bamenda took part in the march past, and then some teachers also marched and some associations.
People that I've spoken with in Bamenda and Boya are saying that the organizers of the boycott has not necessarily been effective because there are too many competing agendas. What are you hearing from the ground, and what's next after this boycott?
In this case, in the Anglophone movement, you cannot pinpoint a leader, you cannot pinpoint the chief organization, even though the more popular, I wouldn't say the most popular, the more institutionalized one is the Southern Cameroon's National Council, the SENC. But even that has splinter groups, and you have other groups around it that have competing agendas, that send out competing messages. But that is not the problem in this case, because as far as these present upheavals are concerned, the main organization that has been at the forefront is what has been called the Consortium of Cameroon Anglophone Civil Society Organizations. But even there, the main leaders, the leader of the group, the president, Barrister Agbo Nkongo Felix Agbobala, and the Secretary General, Dr. Neba Fontem, are in detention in Yaoundé. The third personality, who was called something like the Director of Operations, Wilfred Tassang, head of a teachers association, is in hiding.
I understand these organizers are talking about teaching Yaoundé a lesson. What lesson are they talking about here?
Talking about punishing the government. Because of that, the government feels hurt. In the eyes of the international community, the government cannot claim it has full control of the country. So that is bringing some kind of satisfaction to the protest groups. But if you ask me what this is going to achieve beyond the satisfaction that the protest groups punished Yaoundé, that is the government in Yaoundé of the Republic of Cameroon, I cannot tell. I hope that they will be able to explain this. Neither do I know any plan of action that has been rolled out beyond this boycott of today, if not just the usual ghost towns and school boycotts. I don't know what else is planned.
Franklin Sone Bayan is an independent multimedia journalist. He spoke with me from somewhere in Cameroon. The leader of the Sierra Leonean Opposition Alliance Democratic Party, or ADP, has issued a 2-week ultimatum to the Electoral Commission to announce the date for next year's presidential election. Mohamed Mansere warned he would organize mass demonstrations at the offices of the Electoral Commission nationwide if the electoral body fails to meet his party's demand. His remark comes after opposition and civil society groups said the delay in announcing the date potentially disadvantages prospective contenders by leaving many political parties unprepared. For reaction, I reached presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Barete in the capital, Freetown.
When it comes to election, we have a constitution that is very clear. In fact, the 1991 constitution, the president has indicated that very clearly during his New Year's message when he was addressing Sierra Leoneans. He told them that the 1991 constitution, the provisions there, everything will be in line with the law. And in fact, if you go to Section 43, Subsection 3 of the Public Election Act of 2012 in Sierra Leone, it is very clear that the Electoral Commission will have to announce the date for presidential election. So when I spoke with them, they said that was just blowing out here, and that as far as they are concerned, the consultations are ongoing with all the stakeholders, and once the decision is reached as provided for by law, they will announce the date.
The opposition and civil society groups have said that the delay in making the announcement could potentially disadvantage prospective contenders by leaving many political parties unprepared to challenge the ruling party during next year's election.
Well, we have a law in our country that elections will be announced at least a year before the elections are held. And as I'm speaking to you, we have still not reached that margin. So this is where I said it is rather preposterous for anybody to insinuate about having an ultimatum. One, they don't have that capacity. And even if they do, I think as a country that respects the rule of law, there are laws in the 1991 Constitution. And the president has made it very crystal clear that as far as he's concerned, consultations are ongoing. And in fact, the National Electoral Commission has even gone public to make it abundantly clear that work is on progress. They are doing their consultation, and they will make sure they announce the date when it is due, as provided for by law.
He said that there would be a nationwide tour where he would ask his supporters to march to all Electoral Commission offices across the country to register their protest of the delay to announce the date for the election, which he said has been the tradition, that by now the Electoral Commission would come out with its calendar to let Sierra Leoneans know when they go to the election so they will be prepared. Don't you think his concerns are legitimate?
Nobody is going to be disadvantaged, because even people in government, we have a law that says if you are receiving money within the Consolidated Revenue Fund, you'll have to resign your position at least a year, depending on the status or the level of governance position you're holding. So for us, everybody is eager as well. And this is where we still continue to vouch for the credibility of the National Electoral Commission. Because so far, as I was made to understand, consultations are ongoing, not just with the presidency, but other political parties and stakeholders, with a view to coming out with a decisive date, so that at the end of the day, nobody will be disadvantaged. And so far, as I'm speaking to you, we have not reached that point yet. But what I suspect here is, Mr. Mansari knows very well that by the time he has indicated about the strike, maybe that is the period that NEC will be able to announce. He wants to lay claim to the unnecessary thing to say, it was because I gave them the ultimatum, that was why they announced. So he also always plays it that way. That is why he is not in sync with the public when it comes to such public pronouncements.
There have been concerns by some Sierra Leoneans that the delay is to allow President Ernest Bai Koroma to have the majority that the ruling party enjoys in parliament to amend the constitution to remove term limits so he can win the election and continue to run the affairs of the country. And that is why the Electoral Commission is delaying.
Well, those are very blatant and flagrant manufactured statements that I will not dignify. The reason being, the president in his New Year's speech has been very categorical that we are going to hold elections soon, and he even advised the public for them to make sure that both intra and extra party differences must be converted to civility so that we cannot have any chaos in the country, so that we can continue the democratic process which he prized to preside over the years. So for us, the president has made it abundantly clear. He is not interested to call for any extension as far as he's concerned, and he believes that he's a Democrat, and he has even mentioned that his own democracy was not one that has been converted. He has always been a democratic life.
Abdoulaye Barrette is the Sierra Leonean presidential spokesman. He spoke with me from Freetown. The Kenyan government has declared the current drought affecting large parts of the country a national disaster. President Uhuru Kenyatta called on the local and international partners to support the government's efforts to contain the situation, which has not only affected human beings and livestock, but also wild animals. Kevin Omolo is a correspondent for the Standard Media Group. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in Kisumu to find out how serious the drought is.
The drought situation, I think it is becoming more serious day by day, especially the northern and northeastern part of Kenya, where the government has declared that at least 2 million people are affected. In the past, we have got reports of people who have died. However, the government has not come out to say these people who have died have really died out of hunger. But it is a dire situation in northeastern and northern part of Kenya, where we have the Turkana, which is semi-arid areas. So there are a lot of interventions which have been coming up. The Eco Society recently launched a program where they want to raise at least 1 billion Kenyan shillings to help in the situation. So the president today came out after pressure from several stakeholders, including the Catholic Church. He has actually declared the drought a national disaster and called upon the international community and other stakeholders to come in, bring money and any form of help that can be used to save the situation.
The president also said the government is upscaling the drought mitigation programs. Do we know what these programs are going to be?
Through the ministries, we have like the Ministry of Devolution and the Ministry of Finance. There has always been a budgetary allocation towards emergencies. So we have had the government trying to beef up this budget by bringing in money from other areas. They are going to use this money to purchase food items and other things that can help these people. But there is also the county government. We have in Kenya, we have around 47 county governments. There are 47 county governments. And according to government reports, around 23 of these counties have been affected by the drought. So there is the Council of Governors, which has come out to push for more funds from their counties, where recently the chairman for the Council of Governors, Mr. Munywa, announced that each of the counties is going to contribute 1 million Kenyan shillings, which will be put toward this program. But apart from that, you know, the main issue here is water. The counties within the northern and the northeastern part of Kenya and the coastal region have not received water for the last 2 years. So the two seasons have gone without rain. Most of the residents of those areas are pastoralists who move from one place to another because of the large herds of cattle that they have. So when there is this drought situation, they tend to move to other areas. And this one has also been leading to conflict between different communities as they struggle to share the little resources that they have in the area.
The government also said it's going to allocate 11 billion shillings to cater for intervention in various sectors. Is there the infrastructure to equitably disperse this help to the people who are in need?
I don't think if the government has exact data on how many people are affected and in which areas. When it comes to drought and hunger, it has always been the northern and the northeastern part of Kenya and parts of coast. So anytime there is such kind of crisis, all the interventions should always move towards those areas, the northern part of Kenya, the northeastern, and the coastal part of Kenya. But this situation has spread to other parts of the country, and I think what the government would need to do is to do an overhaul of data analysis to know which parts of the country are really affected. Because when this money is released, it is probably that it would be distributed unequally. It will go to areas which have always been known to suffer the effects of drought situation. So you might get other parts of the country not feeling the importance, or they are not benefiting from this money.
Kevin Omolo is a correspondent for the Standard Media Group in Kenya. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impoga from Kisumu. The United Nations and Congolese authorities are appealing for $748 million to provide what they say will be life-saving assistance for 6.7 million people across the country. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
More than two decades of conflict and widespread atrocities have left millions of people in the Democratic Republic of Congo unable to cope with the daily necessities of life. Instead of getting better, the situation in this enormous country is getting worse, and the needs are increasing. The appeal this year is 8% higher than last and reflects a new three-year strategy. The spokesman for the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, Jens Laerke, says the new action plan involves a more integrated approach in dealing with the country's recurring crises.
The families, communities, men, women and children in the Congo that we are trying to help, they are facing acute vulnerabilities. A lot of that is caused by no or very little access to basic goods and services. There's also a protection crisis related to the conflict and the violence, particularly in the eastern part of the DRC.
Laerke notes the western and central provinces suffer from generalized poverty that also requires humanitarian attention. Among other things, he says money from the appeal will target more than 2 million internally displaced people and about 500,000 young children suffering from acute malnutrition. In addition, he says hundreds of thousands of people are threatened by diseases, epidemics, and food shortages, especially in areas of conflict. He says a part of the appeal also will go to assist a growing number of refugees fleeing intensified fighting in South Sudan. The UN Refugee Agency reports 68,000 South Sudanese have sought asylum in DRC. Layerke says the refugees and the host communities will need humanitarian assistance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spark from our collection of music from the continent. And right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Sina, kichoni kwangu kibanzi, ninaka penda kamanzi, licha kumthamini kama shiringi, tatizo atara sina, ufinyungo ni zangu, unataza mumengi, anunipa mateso, wala takupenda sinara, unanakonda kwa mawazo, masikini penzi langu jina, licha katana kauliro inatoka kesho, kutunzi mumaragi, mumaragi, tanijuta kupenda. We'll be right back.
Look up! Record.
Nimekuwa kama samaki kutamani nisivyoweza, kama nitanga niliapa nioe muweza, na kama bahati mwenzenu nilishapoteza, sikuizi ujanja nikunywa mchuzi wa kweza. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani, ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani, ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, mujini musingi kiuno, kisha tendwa ndo bye bye. Ya msondo mumpe ngurumo, ayo mengine hayo mfai. Mwana penzi limechacha nae, wache niguse niachane nae, asini gande nigombane nae, hakuna mapenzi usibishane nae. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani, ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Aya maneno alinena wazee wa zamani, ukiwa mjanja kuchapiwa ni siri ya ndani. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Masikini roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi, roho yangu mimi achie wewe na zako. Mengi
Bidum bido, you drive me crazy. Bidum bido, my love. Untala bidum bido, nande bidum bido. Untala bidum bido, nande bidum bido.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed the selection. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, an old pot never lacks food remains. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
An editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As the emergency in the south of Madagascar continues into the lean season between harvests, the United States government has donated an additional $2.7 million to emergency relief. There are still nearly a million desperate people who don't have enough to eat. Right now, as we head into the heart of the lean season, when people are suffering the most is when more action is needed by all parties, said U.S. Ambassador Robert Yamate. Ambassador Yamate stressed the importance of a formal emergency declaration from Madagascar, which could open up more options for the international community to respond and provide more aid for relief efforts. The funds were provided by USAID's Office of Food for Peace and will be used to buy food supplies, including rice and green peas, to be distributed to communities without enough to eat. Since 2014, the United States government has been the leading contributor to emergency assistance in southern Madagascar, providing over $39 million of assistance and food supplies. Through USAID, the U.S. government has funded the work of Catholic Relief Services, the World Food Program, the Adventist Development and Relief Agencies, and others. These organizations have also worked together to ensure that relief efforts are coordinated and have supported each other to cover any gaps in food supplies. Through these organizations, the U.S. is funding the delivery of life-saving food aid, seeds to grow new crops, farm supplies and tools, livestock and training in animal husbandry, and specialized nutritious supplements to prevent starvation among malnourished children and pregnant and lactating women. The late arrival of rains is expected to delay the harvest season by another 5 to 8 weeks, and additional support is needed to carry these communities through this extended lean season, said USAID Mission Director Michelle Godet. The $2.7 million we have announced will be provided to the World Food Program and will allow them to continue activities that are feeding 260,000 people daily.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.